I was to tell you that we could predict the future, that we could transport somebody to another world, that we could cure blindness, you might say that I'm crazy, right? These things, these previously moonshot ideas that some people would have said are crazy not that long ago, that are, you know, foolish ideas, they're possible. We're working on them.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winodo.
Our guest today is Dr. Tom Osborne, Director of the VA National Center for Collaborative Healthcare Innovation, and he's also Chief Medical Informatics Officer of the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. The VA is the biggest healthcare system in the U.S. and maybe the world. So Tom, working in Palo Alto, embodies two polar opposites, big federal government and Silicon Valley innovations. What you learned today is that this combination offers really big opportunities. The key resource that the VA has is an incredibly large data set for many patients over a long time period. This is attractive to innovators who want to use machine learning to identify patterns and use them to predict what will happen to patients. So doctors can have advanced warning and act ahead of time to prevent drastic events such as falls or acute kidney injury. Speaking of predicting the future, anyone who knew Tom's early life story would not have predicted that he would go to college, let alone graduate from Dartmouth Medical School and become a neuroradiology fellow at Harvard. His story is truly inspiring and something that we all need to hear during this time of crisis that we are facing right now. I hope you enjoy our conversation. If you like what you hear today, please follow us at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google Podcasts. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. I met you last year. I would joke that it was last decade at the VA hospital. And I thought it would be interesting for our community to hear about what your role at the VA, what the VA is doing in the innovation, but it's also about you. And so I always like to ask people about their background, how they get to healthcare, what make you passionate about healthcare, what's your story?
Christine, thank you. I mean, it's a privilege and a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me. As we were talking earlier before we started, everyone has their story. My story is a little unexpected for someone in my position. I started, I don't know how far back you want to go, but I was born on a farm.
So you're not a doctor family.
Definitely not a doctor family. In fact, very far from that. So we were living on a 100-year-old farm about 2 hours away from the nearest hospital. And, you know, for a kid growing up in that kind of world, you know, to me, I didn't know any different. And it was magical. You know, we had old farm tractors that were broken that I could figure out, you know, how they worked. We had feral animals that I was playing with. You know, it was like a different world. And, you know, as a kid, you don't really think much about the fact that you're drinking from a well that smells of sulfur or that your mom says that, you know, I know spring is coming because of this sweet and pungent smell of defrosting manure is now in the air, you know? So, my family comes from a very, very different place than a lot of medical people. And for me, I didn't know any different. It was great. And it did strike me, though, as strange that when tragic things happen, like, farm injuries. Like one time my dad, he had a chainsaw accident and cut significantly through his leg. The ambulance never came. And we had an old pickup truck. And after a while, my mom finally made the decision to throw him in the truck and we watched them go away and
wow.
To the hospital. Down
How old
the
were
road.
You?
Two, three wow. maybe. So that is a perspective that sort of has stuck with me a little bit. You know, we were, you know, proud and resourceful and poor, but we made it work. And the thing that was sort of tough for me, I really had a fascination with how things worked, with the mechanics, the things that I saw at the farm, and the nature and the world around me. But I didn't have any role models to sort of pursue that. It was all just observation. And so there was no pathway for me in academics. There was no sort of understanding that, you know, there was even a possibility for medicine. And so I went to college on sort of a moonshot idea, and with a lot of resistance from the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And
none of your parents were college graduate.
Yeah, everyone thought it was a crazy idea. And quite frankly, a lot of people were against it. A lot of people that I held with, you know, authority were not that supportive. And I secretly hatched this sort of idea that I was going to do something more than I had exposure to. But I didn't, I mean, I had this passion like many of us,
right,
that you want to do more, but I had no idea even what the options were. So I took a couple of classes that I felt were in the direction. And biology was easy for me.
This is when you're in college.
In college, yeah. Mm-hmm. Bio was easy for me. But chemistry, oh my gosh, I had no foundation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first day of chemistry 101, I sat down. I knew, you know, I was resourceful. I was a hard worker. I knew I was going to make this work. I knew no one was going to work harder than me.
Uh-huh.
Sat in the front row and got there early. And then a professor started talking. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I was like, is this even English? You know, it was like Charlie Brown's Parents. And like with a half grin, I turned to the girl next to me and I was like, you know, like almost if to say this guy's crazy. I was like, what is this guy talking about? Expecting her to say the same. And then she smiled back at me almost to say that this is on a curve and you're helping me out. She says, this is all review from high school. And at that point, I knew I was dead in the water. So I, as fast as I could, I dropped that course. And then I figured out, I was like, I still want to do this. How am I going to figure this out? So I bought a chemistry book, a high school chemistry book, and another college chemistry book. And the next summer, after work, I taught myself one page at a time chemistry. And the next semester, I aced that course.
But where do you have that tenacity to keep on taking it? You could have said, like, you know what? Screw chemistry. I'll do something else.
It's a very good question. I don't know. It's a great question. You know, what drives us? You know, what really pushes us? And I had a burning desire inside of me to do something more.
Mm.
And I feel myself getting a little choked up thinking about it. You know, where I was so different. I mean, it's a different person, a different reality, different possibilities from where I am now. It was hard.
Yeah.
And it was hard because...
Especially when you're at home, nobody thinks that you should be in college either.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, without the support that would have been really helpful. Not just emotional and support, but financial support. I mean, I was cut off.
Yeah.
And there were times when there wasn't enough money, you know, and you had to choose between, you know, rent and food and tuition. And I always paid for tuition and I would often go hungry and sometimes homeless.
Wow.
So I could stay in school.
That is hard. But you somehow managed to navigate it and complete your college degree.
Yeah, exactly. So thanks. Yeah, you know, to take these courses and, you know, for medical school, you really have to ace them. And I was fortunate that I had some great professors and some people around me that really supported me and took the extra effort and, you know, maybe for good or bad, when the utilities went out, I spent more time at the library and, you know, and I worked really hard, like many of us do.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough. I really haven't told this story to anybody. This is interesting. So, you know, attach this plan, these are more of a moonshot, to go to medical school. And everyone told me that was crazy and that was naive and short-sighted and impossible. But fortunately, I went and I graduated from Dartmouth.
Right.
And then I went on to Harvard. And
you're like the American dream story.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, it was an unexpected path, and a lot of there was a lot of luck and hard work that came together in a fortunate way for me.
Yeah, and I think also probably, I mean, I'm sure there's a luck, but I think your ability to find the right people who are supportive of you, I think that takes some certain skills. That I think sometimes we underestimate that, the importance of the ability to find who can be your ally and your advocate.
That's a really great point. And I really like the way you frame that, because none of us can do this alone, right? No matter what we want to do of importance. And navigating that, and, you know, sometimes it's luck being, you know, coming across great people like you. And sometimes it's tenacity and navigating on your own. But you make a really good point. Like, those key people along your path that support you and guide you and are mentors are critical for anybody's success.
Yeah. And so you went to medical school, and I hope your parents felt like, gosh, boy, we were wrong.
Oh, if only that was true. Yes. Some people are, my mom has always been supportive, and other people, but not everybody has been. And my sisters have been supportive, but there were plenty of other authorities in my life that were the exact opposite, unfortunately. And so you got to, many of us come to a conclusion at some point that you cannot take everybody's advice on equal footing or their input. You know, some people have more legitimacy at the table in your mind than others. Mm-hmm. And, sometimes we have to filter out what a lot of people are saying, no matter how credible we once thought that they were.
Yeah, no, I think that if only we were taught when we were young. I always told my son, but, you know, those who mind don't matter. Those who matter, they don't mind. And, you know, I think sometimes we worry too much about what other people think of us.
It's a great phrase.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So you did the medical school. You're in the interventional neuroradiology. What that field?
So good question. So in medical school, as many people who go through the process, you get exposed to a lot of different things. And when I was exposed to radiology, I thought it was really fascinating. I mean, I've always been interested in technology and doing, you know, and also medicine was a combination that came together in radiology in ways that I just wasn't expecting. I didn't know anything about radiology before. And so one day I was taking care of a woman who had a surgery, and she was, you know, really doing badly. She was hypovolemic. Her heart rate was going up. Her blood pressure was going down. So she looked really bad and nobody knew why. And eventually came to the conclusion that she must be bleeding internally. And so she was brought into the interventional radiology suite, which I've never seen or heard of before. And a radiologist came in and made a small little pinprick in her thigh and navigated a catheter up into her vessels and was able to use the machinery, the fluoro and contrast, and quickly identify where the problem was. And not only identify the problem, but fix it with the same catheter. And she was okay in no time, where otherwise she'd have to have a large surgery and huge complications to go around with it. And I saw this and I was like, oh my gosh, this is the future of medicine. This is Star Trek. I want to be part of this. And so then I went down the path to find out more. And the more I found out, the more engaging it was.
Mm-hmm. It's a very growing field too, I think, now. So
So, but I also want to talk about your current role now at the VA. So you joined the VA, what, 2.5 years ago or so?
Yeah, a little more than 2 years ago.
And so can you tell us more about your role? Like, because you're in innovation, but you're also the Chief Medical Information Officer. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I started the VA, as you said, the role that I started with was very similar to roles that I've had in the past. So I've always been combining medicine and technology and innovation to make healthcare more efficient and safer and more effective. And so those are the areas that I'm really interested in. And for no other reason that it's scalable. You're able to do things in ways that can be shared and can help many more people. So that's sort of an engaging spot. So at the VA, I saw the VA as a place that had tons of potential, tons of resources, but a difficult time pulling all those different pieces together and to create something that was more than it would have been with the individual parts. You know, the whole is greater than the individual parts. So knowing that that's a skill that I had and something that I was able to pull different people and different disciplines together, and the potential of the VA, and the VA is huge, that is a path that seemed really appealing. And so being in Silicon Valley is also pretty cool considering our shared interests. So the initial role and currently the still role is CMIO, Chief Medical Informatics Officer. And what we do is really three things. One is clinical applications, which is our electronic health record. We have a team that maintains and supports and trains people on our EHR. The other is modernization, and that is to bring new technologies into the VA that are available elsewhere, but currently are not. And there's a lot of bureaucratic reasons why that's difficult, but working on ways to make that more effective and efficient. And then the last is innovation, which I'm really passionate about. And so we're juggling those three things, and innovation became more and more engaging and interesting, especially because we were able to connect and collaborate with big partners in town. Mm-hmm. And that's like fantastic because you use the best of breed. You know, the best of the clinical side, the best of the technical side. And if you just pull it together, we can do fantastic stuff. Mm-hmm. And so with the help of some of my buddies at VHA Innovations in the VA, which is a national office, we came up with a plan to create a national center that would develop these new technologies in Silicon Valley and act as an incubator, test things out, and the best of them would then be shared with the rest of the country.
So is the idea that the technology come within the VA, or you're open to bring technology from people from the outside to come to the VA?
Great question. Yes, for both. And so sometimes, to your point, sometimes we develop stuff inside the VA alone, and sometimes we reach out to partners and say, we have this idea, we need some help with it. And sometimes the partners will say, hey, we know you have this challenge and we have some tools that would help. And then we start to collaborate. Sometimes they're academics, sometimes they're industry, sometimes they're other government agencies.
Mm-hmm. So give us an example. If, say, we have I'm just trying to think about the startup in our community. They would love to be part of the VA solution. And what is the best way for them to engage with somebody like you or the VA in general? I mean, the potential of being in the VA is like, once you're in, you have national.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's a great point. Yeah. So there's no shortage of people who are interested. When I say people, I'm talking like people who have businesses to be part of the VA. It's the largest healthcare system in the United States and quite possibly the world. And it has great potential, not only for our veterans, but the solutions that we create here can have far-reaching positive implications for the rest of the world because we can develop things that are applicable to all kinds of people. So your specific question about how someone could get into the VA, that's a very interesting and complicated question. At a high level, it's about alignment, you know, as many things are.
Right.
And it's aligning the incentives of both parties, finding where there's common ground, and to see if we can create an agreement where the roles and responsibilities make sense for everybody involved, and it's shared resources and shared benefits. And that can come in all kinds of different forms. You know, it can come in all kinds of solutions can come out of that. We're doing a lot of projects with AI, with, you know, specifically machine learning, some NLP. We're doing stuff with virtual reality and augmented reality, a bunch of projects in that space, with sensors, sensor technology, with big data, mm-hmm. Basically the full gamut of mm-hmm. possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of, in, you know, that's probably similar to any company who wants to get involved with any medical centers, right? It's almost finding somebody who found that there's potential value in their technology and they want to try it out. I think that's kind of
exactly right.
Similar that way.
Exactly right. And like any of these things that's developed, as you well know, I know you're in this space and you live and breathe it, it's always best to start with a problem and then look for the best solution to solve that problem, as opposed to many times, which can happen with really excited technical people, is they come up with a tool and they say, what can we do? How can we, what problem can we solve with this? It's usually not as successful. Mm-hmm. And so we like to start with a problem, understand it really well, all the requirements, and then try to find a way to have partnerships to solve that problem as effectively as possible.
Okay. So the other things that you mentioned about trying to bring innovation from within as well, what are the sort of things that you do to catalyze that innovation within? Because when people think about the VA hospital, they're like government.
Yeah.
And government is not the first, you know, things that you think about when it comes to innovation.
Yeah, that's awesome. So especially some of the ideas of recent about the VA, I think the VA is doing a lot of great stuff, but the VA is not really focused on marketing. And so maybe the VA doesn't do as good a job at publicizing the great work that they do, as opposed to maybe, you know, other companies where that's more of a business imperative. And for the VA, you know, we're focused on taking care of veterans. That's our focus. That's our number one. So we spend resources in different ways than maybe somebody else does, and that's reflected in what people hear about it.
Right.
So for the VA, I mean, the VA really, we pioneered the EHR in the 60s before anybody was thinking
right.
about it. So the VA's got a, you know, and then Hep C, you know, the vaccine for that is developed in the VA, and tons of other really important technologies and innovations. But you make a really good point. There is a lot of roadblocks and bureaucracy within the VA. Mm-hmm. And there's no, that I know of, there's no sort of playbook or rule book or silver bullet about how to get into the VA. You know, mm-hmm. you can't like go to a website and if you're a company and, you know, hey, I want to sell my products or be part of the VA.
Fill out this form, wait, A, B, C, D.
Yeah, right. That doesn't exist. You usually start with someone who's an engaged product champion. And if it's a commercial off-the-shelf product, there is a process for that. It's sort of in the modernization category. And then it goes through the standard process of procurement. And that's to ensure that it's a fair process for everybody involved. But when it comes to innovation, it's kind of different because we're cutting edge. We're building stuff that doesn't exist. So you can't exactly buy that off the shelf. And we are often creating things that no one else has anywhere. And so for your specific question about what we're doing within the VA, we are doing some really fascinating stuff, or within government for that mm-hmm. matter. So we have collaborative agreements with the Department of Energy. They have the largest supercomputer in the world. Mm-hmm. Isn't it a great idea that we use it for healthcare and solve problems? We have an agreement with the Department of Defense, and there's a really interesting AI project that we're working on with them, and we have a roadmap to do a mm-hmm. whole lot more.
Can you tell us more about the projects?
I would love to. Let me go back a step. So I was to tell you that we could predict the future, that we could transport somebody to another world, that we could cure blindness. You might say that I'm crazy, right? These things, these previously moonshot ideas that some people would have said are crazy not that long ago, that are, you know, foolish ideas, they're possible. We're working on them. And to go back to your earlier questions about my youth, there were many people that said that this pathway of mine was crazy, was foolish, was a waste of time. And here we are with a larger group of people coming together with more horsepower and bandwidth to do what was once science fiction. Mm-hmm. We can predict the future with healthcare, with data, mm-hmm. with machine learning. So we can take data that previously exists in the healthcare system, which collected...
But you guys have.
We have more than anybody else.
Right.
The most robust longitudinal database that goes back further than anybody else. Veterans stay in our healthcare system. They don't tend to leave because right. we treat them well. And they also, we're collecting a lot of important data so we can take care of them. So all that data can be used to train, for example, a machine learning algorithm to understand what variables lead to a specific outcome. Mm-hmm. And if we understand that, then we can classify patients in different categories and put metrics and criteria to when different things will happen in ways that haven't happened before. So, for example, I'm going to skip to a project that I can talk about freely because it's been published. We did a retrospective analysis with EHR data to understand what leads up to acute kidney injury, which is a devastating disease, and it happens to a lot of patients. And typically, this disease is only detected at the last minute when it's often too late to change the course, and there's a lot of morbidity and mortality associated with that. So a machine learning algorithm co-developed with DeepMind, which is now part of Google, was able to accurately predict who was going to get this disease 2 days before it happens. Mm. That's sort of an amazing thing, because now we can suddenly do something about it where we couldn't before. And this could be applicable to many different disease processes, I mean, thousands, really. And so we're in a position where we can predict the future with advanced technology. We can understand what's happened, follow that trajectory, and see where it's going to lead. And if we know what's going to happen in the mm-hmm. future, we can actually do something about it to avoid bad things or to treat it in ways that we couldn't before.
Sometimes, oftentimes, when I see a lot of technology is trying to prevent something to happen, and like prevent falling, for example, but also the challenge that the startup face is that how do you show the value
yeah.
for things that has not happened
yeah.
yet?
Yeah.
And I guess maybe in your case, it's slightly different because the VA is, you know, it's a closed loop system.
Yeah.
So then you see that, you know, the benefit
yeah.
of you taking care of that patient. How do you, you know, balance that if you're from the outside? You just go to VA and forget about everybody else.
No, that's a good question. So you brought up falls, which is great because we have about 5 different internal projects currently going on to solve falls in multiple different ways. Falls, right? $50 billion a year, according to CMS, right. is how much it costs. And, you know, that's certainly just a dollar amount, but that reflects the physical impact on that number of patients that would have to lead up to that number. So it's really important. I mean, and it happens more to older adults than anybody else. VA has more older adults than anybody else. And, you know, the consequences of a fall are hip fracture, wrist fracture, subdural hematoma, things that put people on the wrong path to bad outcomes quickly. So if we can predict who's at risk for fall, mm-hmm. we can actually do some interventions before it happens. And there's all kinds of interventions. If we can add technologies to not only do the job better, but to prevent it, all the better. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different ways we can do that. And we can do that internally with our own internal data to utilize existing EHR data, like the other example, to classify people in different categories. What leads to the fall, and statistically, mm-hmm. who's most likely to get the fall. Mm-hmm. Now that we know that, we can set flags in our system to say this patient is at risk for fall. We have to treat them differently than the rest of the population. Mm-hmm. We have to assess them to a greater degree. We need to evaluate why they're at risk for fall and have custom interventions for that person. And then we're getting into personalized medicine. So it really makes sense more than ever before.
That's exciting too. make that happen. So is that mean, like, for the acute kidney injury, going back to your acute kidney injury project, so you can predict that? Are you going to share it with the rest of the healthcare system, or are you going to keep it at the VA? That's and if you're sharing, what does that mean?
That's a great question. So that's a great question. So for that sort of very specific example, that was a process or a project that was done in collaboration with an outside party. And so that was also done on retrospective data, historical data. And it was a proof of concept. It was showing that we can do this, that the data will allow us to accurately do this. The next step in that workflow is to do all the things we need to do to incorporate that into clinical care, and then to evaluate it in a rigorous way to confirm that it actually is what we thought it would be. Mm-hmm. So we do have work to do before we can actually, you know, say it's a home run, mm-hmm. but everything points in that direction. We just want to do our due diligence. At some point, the owners of the IP, mm-hmm. which is often the people who build the technology, are going to be in a position to commercialize this. Mm-hmm. And in depending on who puts in what amount of work, there will be lawyers who decide who owns the IP. Mm-hmm. And we have a program for that, TTP. And then, you know, that's sort of not my wheelhouse, yeah. but I know that it's very important for those people involved. And when the incentives are in alignment, again, and there's a market, then very smart business people will find a way to commercialize it.
Mm-hmm. And so I remember in the early, like many years ago, when everybody talking about the electronic health record, I remember saying, like, you should just go to the VA and then, you know, ask them to give it to you. But everybody wants to build their own.
Yes.
I think that's also sometimes people want to build their own.
Yeah.
Rather than having some. But in this case, probably this is harder. So the technology work, I'm sure there's a lot more people wants to adopt.
Well, to your point, the EHR that the VA developed years and years ago, is the GUI for it is CPRS, and the core of it is called Vista. That is open source. Mm. The VA developed it and made it available. There are countries around the world that use it for their EHR. And the VA doesn't make anything off of that I know of. It's freely available.
The Epic McBillions.
It is, yeah, right. Well, we don't market it, yeah. right? And Epic and Cerner, they have a different business model.
Yeah, yeah. So as a chief medical informatics officers, what keep you up at night? What worries you? Like, you know, when you think about information these days, everybody's so afraid about security.
Sure.
And sometimes I feel like, really? But yeah. It is, right?
Yeah.
What are the things that worries you?
So definitely security is an issue. You know, we work very hard to be diligent about the security and how we do things. And so we work all the time to get alignment with all major stakeholders. If it's a research project, obviously research, we have privacy, security, we have the lawyers, we have so many different stakeholders involved. And we always try to do as much as we can with least amount of personal identifiable information as possible. And oftentimes we can do a lot of great work with the identified data, or even scrambled data that becomes to the point where it's really synthetic, where no one could ever re-identify it. So I feel really good about the work that my team has done in that space. Nonetheless, it is something we think about all the time. So to answer your question about, you know, what keeps me up at night, that's something we think about. I don't know if it keeps me up at night as much as other things. The thing that I think most about and that sort of gets me out of bed early in the morning is the fact that we have so much to do and so little time. Our healthcare system is at a critical point. It is at a precipice and not in a good way. We have three titanic forces coming together. Any one of them could be devastating, mm-hmm. but together they're so acute. And the fact that we are not addressing it with the amount of horsepower that I think we should be is surprising. So the three circles in this Venn diagram, we have a growing older population with multiple comorbidities. And that's, you know, that's a testament to how successful we've been treating diseases. People are living longer. What we haven't done a good job, in my opinion, is they're living longer, but are they living as well as they could be? We need to figure out how to keep people healthier in their old age, not just they're living longer. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of one circle. Another circle is we do not have enough providers available currently. And there's a there's a growing gap between the number of providers who are available and the number of patients who need them. And the patient population is getting older and older and with more and more needs. And there's less and less healthcare providers proportionally to take care of them. So there's a huge chasm there. And the last thing is we spend $3 trillion a year in healthcare, 20% of our GDP, and it's only going up. There's so many other things that we could spend our money on. You know, infrastructure, going to Mars, whatever it is, you know, education. There's so many other things that 20%, maybe if it's just, you know, 15%, we could do a lot more as a country. And the only way that I know we can solve all these different things coming together is to change the paradigm, to change the model of care. Because the current model was built for a different world and a different reality. And now we have technology. And it's thoughtfully implemented technology, not just technology for technology's sake, but thoughtfully implemented technology has the chance to solve these problems and to do it in a way that's efficient and also scalable, where it then can, once you get it right, you can share it with so many other people. So that's the type of stuff that keeps me up at night.
I'm glad that's more exciting to be worried about that one.
Exactly.
I think that... thank you for sharing that, and you're passionate about it, and I feel like I'm looking forward to see what's next come and looking forward to find a way for us to collaborate.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.